We mustn't kill these men. They are too valuable. What if this opportunity presents itself again? But you agreed. I never expected things would go this well. The schedule I worked up assumed that you and I... No, I shall be honest, that I would have to supervise everything. You, Ibrahim, have astounded me with your skill. What we have done here is to have assembled a superb team. We must keep this team together. And where else will we get 10 kilos of plutonium? Gon wanted to ask. Manfred, I think you are correct. I will discuss this with the commander. You must remember, security. Ich weiß es schon. We can take no chances at this stage. I merely entreat you as a matter of justice, of professional recognition, yeah? That consideration must be given. Do you understand? Quite well, Manfred. I agree with you. The German was acquiring humanity, Gon thought. A pity it came so late. In any case, I also agree with your desire for a decent dinner before we begin the final phase. Tonight, there is fresh lamb, and we've obtained some German beer. Bitburger? I hope you like it. A good regional lager. A pity, Ibrahim, that your religion denies it to you. On this night, Gon said, I hope Allah will forgive me for indulging. Just as well, Ibrahim thought, to earn the infidel's confidence. Jack, it would appear that you were working too hard. It's the commute, sir. 2 or 3 hours a day in a car. Find a place closer? His Royal Highness suggested gently. Give up Peregrine Cliff? Ryan shook his head. Then what about Kathy and Johns Hopkins? Then there's the kids, taking them out of school. No, that's no solution. You doubtless recall that the first time we met, you commented rather forcefully on my physical and psychological condition. I rather doubt that I looked as dreadful as you do now. The prince had received more than one bit of information from Sir Basil Charleston, Jack noted, as a result of which there was no alcohol being served with dinner. It blows hot and cold at work. At the moment, it's blowing rather hot. Truman, then, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen? Yes, sir, something like that. But it'll cool off. Just that we have some things happening now. It's like that. When you were driving your ship, it was like that too, wasn't it? That was much healthier work. I also had a far shorter distance to commute. About 15 feet, as a matter of fact, he added with a chuckle. Ryan laughed rather tiredly. Must be nice. For me, it's that far to see my secretary. And the family. There was no sense in lying. Could be better. My work doesn't help. Something is troubling you, Jack. It's quite obvious, you know. Too much stress. I've been hitting the booze too hard. Not enough exercise. The usual. It'll get better. Just, I've had a longer than usual stretch of bad times at the office. I appreciate your concern, sir, but I'll be all right. Jack almost convinced himself that it was true. Almost. As you say. And I must say that's the best dinner I've had in a very long time. So, when's the next time you're coming over to our side of the pond? Ryan asked, grateful for the chance to change subjects. Late spring. A breeder in Wyoming will have some horses for me. Polo ponies, actually. You gotta be crazy to play that game. Lacrosse on horses. Well, it gives me a chance to enjoy the countryside. Magnificent place, Wyoming. I plan to tour Yellowstone also. Never been there, Jack said. Perhaps you could come with us then. I might even teach you how to ride. Maybe, Jack allowed, wondering how he'd look on a horse, and wondering how the hell he'd be able to get away from the office for a week. just so you don't wave one of those hammers at me. Mallet, Jack, mallet. I shan't try to involve you in polo. You'd probably end up killing some unfortunate horse. I presume you'll be able to find the time. I can sure try. If I'm lucky, the world will settle down a little by then. It's settled down quite a bit, thanks in large part to your work. Sir, Basil may have placed a little too much emphasis on what I did. I was just one cog in the machine. Modesty can be overdone. I find it disappointing that you failed to receive any recognition, the prince observed. That's life, isn't it? Jack was surprised at how it came out. For once he'd been unable to hide his feelings completely. I thought as much. Yes, Jack, that's life. And life is not always fair. Have you thought, perhaps, about changing your line of work? Take leave, perhaps? Jack grinned. Come on. I don't look all that bad. They need me at the office. His Royal Highness became very serious. Jack, are we friends? Brian sat upright in his chair. I don't have all that many, but you're one of them. Do you trust my judgment? Yes, sir, I do. Get out. Leave. You can always come back to it. A person of your talents never really leaves, you know that. I don't like the way you look. You've been at it too long. Have you any idea how lucky you are that you can leave? You have a degree of freedom. I do not. Use it. Nice try, man. If you were in my position, you wouldn't leave. Same reason, even. I'm not a quitter. Neither are you. It's that simple. Pride can be a destructive force, the prince pointed out. Jack leaned forward. It's not pride. It's fact. They do need me. I wish they didn't, but they do. Problem is, they don't know it. Is the new director that bad? Marcus is not a bad person, but he's lazy. He likes his position better than he likes his duties. I don't suppose that's a problem limited to the American government, is it? I know better. So do you. Duty comes first. Maybe you're stuck with your job because you were born into it, but I'm just as stuck with mine, because I'm the guy best able to do it. Do they listen to you? His Highness asked sharply. Jack shrugged. Not always. Hell, sometimes I'm wrong. But there has to be somebody there who does the right thing, at least tries to. That's me, sir. That's why I can't bug out. You know that just as well as I do. Even if it harms you? Correct. Your sense of duty is admirable, Sir John. I had a couple of good teachers. You didn't run and hide when you knew you were a target. You could have done that. No, I could not have done so. If I had, the bad guys would have won. Jack finished the thought. My problem isn't very different, is it? I learned part of this from you. Surprised? Jack asked. Yes, he admitted. You don't run away from things. Neither do I. Your verbal maneuvering is as skillful as ever. See? I haven't lost it yet. Jack was rather pleased with himself. I will insist that you bring the family out to Wyoming with us. You can always go over my head. Talk to Kathy. His Highness laughed. Perhaps I will. Flying back tomorrow? Yes, sir. I'm going to hit Hamley's for some toys. Get yourself some sleep, Jack. We'll have this argument again next year. It was 5 hours earlier in Washington. Liz Elliott stared across her desk at Bob Holtzman, who covered the White House. Like the permanent staffers here, Holtzman had seen them come and go, outlasting them all. His greater experience in the building was something of a paradox. Though necessarily cut out of the really good stuff, Holtzman knew that there were some secrets he'd never see until years too late to make a story of them. That was the work of historians. His skill at reading nuances and catching whiffs would have earned him a senior place at any intelligence agency. But his paper paid much better than any government agency, especially since he'd also penned a few best-selling books on life at the highest levels of government. This is deep background? That's right, the National Security Advisor said. Holtzman nodded and made his notes. That set the rules. No direct quotes. Elizabeth Elliot could be referred to as an administration official, or in the plural as sources within. He looked up from his notebook. Tape recorders were also out for this sort of interview, and waited. Liz Elliot liked her drama. She was a bright woman, somewhat elitist, not an uncommon trait in White House officialdom, and definitely the person closest to the president if he was reading the signals right. But that was none of the public's business. The probable love affair between the president and his national security advisor was no longer a complete secret. The White House staffers were as discreet as ever, more, in fact. He found it odd that they should be so. Fowler was not the most lovable of men. Perhaps they felt sympathy for what had to be a lonely man. The circumstances of his wife's death were well known, and had probably added a percentage point of sympathy votes in the last election. Maybe the staffers thought he'd change with a steady romance in his life. Maybe they were just being good professionals. That distinguished them from political appointees, Holtzman thought. Nothing was sacred to them. Maybe Fowler and Elliot were just being very careful. In any case, the White House press had discussed it off and on at the confidential source, the bar at the National Press Club building just two blocks away, and it had been decided that Fowler's love life was not properly a matter of public interest so long as it did not injure his job performance. After all, his foreign policy performance was pretty good. Euphoria from the Vatican Treaty and its stunningly favorable aftermath had never gone away. You couldn't slam a president who was doing so fine a job. "We may have a problem with the Russians," Elliot began. "Oh?" Holtzman was caught by surprise for once. "We have reason to believe that Narmanov is having considerable difficulty dealing with his senior military commanders. That could have effects on final compliance with the arms treaty." "How so?" "We have reason to believe that the Soviets will resist elimination of some of their SS-18 stocks. They're already behind in destruction of the missiles." Reason to believe. Twice. Holtzman thought about that for a moment. A very sensitive source, probably a spy rather than an intercept. "They say that there's a problem with the destruct facility. The inspectors we have over there seem to believe them. Possibly the factory was designed with, what do you call it, creative incompetence." "What's the agency say?" Holtzman asked, scribbling his notes just as fast as he could. "They gave us the initial report, but so far they've been unable to get us a real opinion." "What about Ryan? He's pretty good on the Soviets." "Ryan's turning into a disappointment," Liz said. "As a matter of fact, and this is something you can't say, you can't use his name, we have a little investigation going that's turned up some disturbing data."
"Like?"
"Like, I think we're getting skewed data. Like, I think a senior agency official is having an affair with a person of foreign birth, and there may be a child involved."
"Ryan?"
The National Security Advisor shook her head. "Can't confirm or deny. Remember the rules."
"I won't forget," Holtzman replied, hiding his annoyance. Did she think she was dealing with Jimmy Olsen?
"The problem is, it looks like he knows we don't like what he's telling us, and as a result, he's trying to put a spin on the data to please us. This is a time when we really need good stuff from Langley, but we're not getting it."
Holtzman nodded thoughtfully. That was not exactly a new problem at Langley, but Ryan wasn't that sort, was he?
The reporter set that aside. "And Narmanov?"
"If what we're getting is in any way correct,
He may be on the way out, whether from the right or the left, we can't say. It may be that he's losing it.
That's solid.
It appears so. The part about blackmail from his security forces is very disturbing.
But with our problems at Langley...
Liz held up her hands.
Just when things were going so well, too. I guess you're having problems with Cabot.
He's learning his job pretty well. If he had better support, he'd be okay.
How worried are you? Holtzman asked.
Very much so. This is a time when we need good intel, but we're not getting it. How the hell can we figure out what to do about Narmanov unless we get good information?
So what do we get? Liz asked in exasperation. Our hero is running around doing stuff that really doesn't concern his agency. He's gone over people's heads to the hill on some things, doing a Chicken Little act on one thing, while at the same time, he's not getting Cabot good analysis on what appears to be a major issue.
Of course, he has his distractions.
Our hero, Holtzman thought. What an interesting choice of words. She really hates the guy, doesn't she?
Holtzman knew the fact, but not the reason. There was no reason for her to be jealous of him. Ryan had never shown great ambition, at least not in a political sense. He was a pretty good man, by all accounts. The reporter remembered his one public faux pas, a confrontation with Al Trent, which Holtzman was certain must have been staged. Ryan and Trent got along very well now, by all accounts. What could possibly have been important enough to stage something like that? Ryan had two intelligence stars. What for, Holtzman had never been able to find out. Just rumors. Five different versions of four different stories. Probably all of them false. Ryan wasn't all that popular with the press. The reason was that he had never really leaked anything. He took secrecy a little too seriously. On the other hand, he didn't try to curry favor either, and Holtzman respected anyone who avoided that. Of one thing he was sure. He had gravely underestimated the antipathy for Ryan in the Fowler administration.
I'm being manipulated. That was as obvious as a peacock in a barnyard. Very cleverly, of course. The bit about the Russians was probably genuine. The Central Intelligence Agency's inability to get vital information to the White House wasn't exactly new either, was it? That was probably true also. So where was the lie? Or was there a lie at all? Maybe they just wanted to get truthful but sensitive information out, in the normal way. It wasn't the first time he'd learned things in the northwest corner office of the White House West Wing. Could Holtzman not do a story on this?
Not hardly, Bobby boy, the reporter told himself.
The ride home was smooth as silk. Ryan caught as much sleep as he could, while the sergeant who took care of the cabin read through assembly instructions for some of the toys Jack had picked up.
Yo, Sarge.
The pilot was back in the cabin for a stretch.
What you doing? Well, Mage, our DV here picked up some stuff for the kiddies.
The NCO handed over a page of directions. Tab 1 into slot A. Use 7/8 bolt. Tighten with a wrench using...
I think I'd rather tinker with broke engines.
Roger that, the sergeant agreed.
This guy's got some bad times ahead.
Chapter 24. Revelation.
I don't like being used, Holtzman said, leaning back with his hands clasped at the base of his neck.
He sat in the conference room with his managing editor, another long-term Washington watcher who'd won his spurs in the feeding frenzy that had ended the presidency of Richard Nixon. Those had been heady times. It had given the entire American media a taste for blood that had never gone away. The only good part about it, Holtzman thought, was that they didn't cozy up to anyone now. Any politician was a potential target for the righteous wrath of America's investigatorial priesthood. The fact of it was healthy, though the extent of it occasionally was not.
That's beside the point. Who cares?
So what do we know is true? The editor asked.
We have to believe her that the White House isn't getting good data, That's nothing new at CIA, though it's not as bad as it used to be. The fact of the matter is that agency performance has improved somewhat. Well, there is the problem that Cabot has looped off a lot of heads. We also have to believe what she says about Narmanov and his military. And Ryan? I've met him at social functions, never officially. He's actually a fairly nice guy, good sense of humor. He must have a hell of a record. 2 intelligence stars. What for, we do not know. He fought Cabot on downsizing the operations directorate, evidently saved a few jobs. He's moved up very fast. Al Trent likes him, despite that run-in they had a few years ago. There's got to be a story in that, but Trent flatly refused to discuss it the only time I asked him. Supposedly, they kissed and made up. And I believe that like I believe in the Easter Bunny. Is he the sort to play around? The editor asked next. What sort is that? You expect they're issued a scarlet A for their shirts? Very clever, Bob. So what the hell are you asking me? Do we run a story on this or not? The editor's eyes widened in surprise. Are you kidding? How can we not run a story on this? I just don't like being used. We've been through that. I don't either. Granted that it's obvious in this case, but it's still an important story. And if we don't run it, then the Times will. How soon will you have it ready? Soon, Holtzman promised. Now he knew why he'd declined a promotion to assistant managing editor. He didn't need the money. His book income absolved him of the necessity of working at all. He liked being a journalist, still had his idealism, still cared about what he did. It was a further blessing, he thought, that he was absolved of the necessity of making executive decisions. The new feedwater pump was everything the master shipwright had promised on the installation side, Captain Dubunin noted. They'd practically had to dismantle a whole compartment to get it in, plus torch a hole through the submarine's double hull. He could still look up and see sky through what should have been a curved steel overhead, something very unnerving indeed for a submarine officer. They had to make sure that the pump worked satisfactorily before they welded shut the soft patch through which it had arrived. It could have been worse. This submarine had a steel hull. Those Soviet submarines made of titanium were the devil to weld shut. The pump steam generator room was immediately aft of the reactor compartment. In fact, the reactor vessel abutted the bulkhead on the forward side and the pump assembly on the after side. The pump circulated water in and out of the reactor. The saturated steam went into the steam generator where it ran through an interface. There its heat caused water in the outside or non-radioactive loop to flash to steam, which then turned the submarine's turbine engines, in turn driving the propeller through reduction gears. The inner loop steam, with most of its energy lost, then ran through a condenser that was cooled by seawater from outside the hull and was pumped as water back into the bottom of the reactor vessel for reheating to continue the cycle. The steam generator and condenser were actually the same large structure, and the same multi-stage pump handled all of the circulation. This one mechanical object was the acoustical Achilles heel of all nuclear-powered ships. The pump had to exchange vast quantities of water that was hot both thermally and radioactively. Doing that much mechanical work had always meant making a large amount of noise. Until now.
It's an ingenious design, Dubunin said. It should be. The Americans spent 10 years perfecting it for their missile submarines, then decided not to use it. The design team was crushed.
The captain grunted. The new American reactor designs were able to use natural convection circulation. One more technical advantage. They were so damnably clever. As both men waited, the reactor was powering up. Control rods were being withdrawn and free neutrons from the fuel elements were beginning to interact, starting a controlled nuclear chain reaction. At the control panel behind the captain and the admiral, technicians called off temperature readings in degrees Kelvin, which started at absolute zero and used Celsius measurements.
In the time now, the master shipwright breathed. You've never seen it in operation, Dubunin asked.
No.
Marvelous, the captain thought, looking up at the sky. What a horrible thing to see from inside a submarine. What was that?
The pump just kicked in.
You're joking. He looked at the massive multi-barrel assembly. He couldn't. Dubinin walked over to the instrument panel and... Dubinin laughed out loud.
It works, Captain, the chief engineer said. Keep running up the power, Dubinin said. 10% now, and rising. Take it all the way to 110.
Captain? I know. We never go over 100. The reactor was rated for 50,000 horsepower, but like most such machines, the maximum power rating was conservative. It had been run at nearly 58,000 once on builder's trials, resulting in minor damage to the steam generator's internal plumbing, and the maximum useful power was 54.96. Dubinin had only done that once, soon after taking command. It was something a ship's commander did, just as a fighter pilot must find out at least one time how fast he can make his aircraft lance through the air.
Very well, the engineer agreed. Keep a close eye on things, Ivan Stepanovich. If you see any problems, shut down at once.
Dubinin patted him on the shoulder and walked back to the front of the compartment, hoping the welders had done their jobs properly. He shrugged at the thought. The welds had all been x-rayed for possible faults. You couldn't worry about everything, and he had a fine chief engineer to keep an eye on things.
20% power.
The master shipwright looked around. The pump had also been mounted on its own small raft structure, essentially a table with spring-loaded legs. They largely prevented transmission of whatever noise the pump generated into the hull, and from there into the water. That, he thought, had been poorly designed. Well, there were always things to be done better. Building ships was one of the last true engineering art forms.
25. I can hear something now, Dubinin said. Speed equivalent. With normal hotel load.
That meant the power required to operate various ship's systems ranging from air conditioning to reading lights.
10 knots.
The Akula class required a great deal of electric power for her internal systems. That was due mainly to the primitive air conditioning systems, which alone ate up 10% of reactor output.
We need 17% power for hotel loadings before we start turning the screw. Western systems are much more efficient.
The master shipwright nodded grumpily.
They have a vast industry concerned with environmental engineering. We do not have the infrastructure to do the proper research yet. They have a much hotter climate. I was in Washington once in July. Hell could scarcely be worse.
That bad?
The embassy chap who took me around said it was once a malarial swamp. They've even had yellow fever epidemics there. Miserable climate.
I didn't know that.
30%, the engineer called.
When were you there? The admiral asked.
Over 10 years ago, for the incidents at sea negotiations. My first and last diplomatic adventure. Some headquarters fool thought they needed a submariner. I was drafted out of Frunze for it. Total waste of time, Dubinin added.
How was it?
Dull. The American submarine types are arrogant. Not very friendly back then.
Dubinin paused.
No, that's not fair. The political climate was very different. The hospitality was cordial but reserved. They took us to a baseball game.
And? The admiral asked.
The captain smiled.
The food and beer were enjoyable. The game was incomprehensible, and their explanations just made things worse.
40%.
12 knots, Dubinin said. The noise is picking up.
But?
But it's a fraction of what the old pump put out. My men have to wear ear protection in here. At full speed, the noise is terrible.
We'll see.
Did you learn anything interesting in Washington?
Another grunt.
Not to walk the streets alone. I went out for a stroll and saw some poor woman attacked by a street hooligan, and, you know, it was only a few blocks from the White House.
Really?
The young crook tried to run right past me with her purse, like something from a film. It was quite amazing.
Tried to?
Did I ever tell you I was a good football player? I tackled him, a little too enthusiastically. Broke his kneecap, as a matter of fact.
Dubinin smiled, remembering the injury he'd inflicted on the worthless bastard. Concrete sidewalks were so much harder than a grassy football pitch.
50%. Then what happened? Then the embassy people went mad about it. The ambassador screamed a lot. Thought they'd send me right home. But the local police talked about giving me a medal. It was hushed up, and I was never asked to be a diplomat again.
Dubinin laughed out loud.
I won. 18 knots.
Why did you interfere?
I was young and foolish, Dubinin explained. Never occurred to me that it might all be some CIA trick. That's what the ambassador was worried about. It wasn't. Just a young criminal and a frail black woman. His kneecap shattered quite badly. I wonder how well he runs now. And if he really was CIA, that's one less spy we have to worry about.
60% power, still very steady, the engineer called. No pressure fluctuations at all.
23 knots. The next 40% power doesn't do very much for us, and the flow noise off the hull starts building up at this point.
Run it up smartly, Vanya.
Aye, Captain.
What's the fastest you've ever had him?
32 at max rated power. 33 on overload.
There's talk about a new hull paint. The stuff the English invented. Intelligence says it adds more than a knot to the American Hunter submarines.
That's right, the Admiral confirmed. I hear we have the formula. But actually making it is very difficult, and applying it properly is even more so.
Anything over 25 and you run the risk of stripping the anechoic tiles off the hull. Had that happen once when I was Starpom on the Sverdlovsky Komsomolets.
Dubinin shook his head.
Like being inside a drum, the way those damned rubber slabs pounded the hull.
Not much we can do about that, I'm afraid.
75% power.
Take those tiles off, and I get another knot.
You don't really advocate that.
Dubinin shook his head.
No. If a torpedo goes into the water, that could be the difference between life and death.
Conversation stopped at that point. In 10 minutes, power had reached 100%, 50,000 horsepower. The pump noise was quite loud now, but it was still possible to hear a person speaking. With the old pump, this power level was like listening to a rock band, Dubinin remembered. You could feel the sound rippling through your body. Not now. And the rafting of the pump body. The yard commander had promised him a vast reduction in radiated noise. He had not been boasting. 10 minutes later, he'd seen and heard everything he'd needed.
Power down, Dubinin commanded.
Well, Valentin Borisovich,
KGB stole this from the Americans.
That is my understanding, the Admiral said.
I may kiss the next spy I meet.
The motor vessel George McCready lay alongside the pier loading cargo. She was a large ship, 10 years old, driven by large, low-speed marine diesels and designed as a timber carrier. She could carry 30,000 tons of finished lumber or, as was the case now, logs. The Japanese preferred to process the lumber themselves for the most part. It kept the processing money in their country instead of having to export it. At least an American flag vessel was being used to do the delivery, a concession that had required 10 months of negotiations. Japan could be a fun place to visit, though rather expensive. Under the watchful eyes of the first officer, gantry cranes lifted the logs from trucks and lowered them into the built-for-the-purpose holds. The process was remarkably speedy.
Automation of cargo loading was probably the most important development in the commercial shipping business. George M. could be fully loaded in less than 40 hours and offloaded in 36, allowing the ship to return to sea very rapidly, but denying her crew the chance to do very much in whatever port they might be visiting. The loss of income for waterfront bars and other businesses that catered to sailors was not a matter of great concern to the shipowners, who did not make money when their hulls were tied alongside the pier.
"Pete, got the weather," the third officer announced.
"Could be better."
The first officer looked at the chart.
"Wow.
Yeah, a monster Siberian low forming up. Gonna get bumpy a couple of days out. It's gonna be too big to dodge, too."
The first officer whistled at the numbers.
"Don't forget your scope patch, Jimmy."
"Right. How much deck cargo?"
"Just those boys over there."
He pointed. The other man grunted, then picked up a pair of binoculars from the holder.
"Christ, they're chained together."
"That's why we can't strike 'em below."
"Outstanding,"
the junior man observed.
"I already talked to the bosun about it. We'll have them tied down nice and tight."
"Good idea, Pete.
If this storm builds like I expect, you'll be able to surf down there."
"Captain's still on the beach?"
"Right. He's due back at 1400.
"Fueling complete.
Cheng will have his diesels online at 1700.
Depart at 1630?
"That's right."
"Damn. The guy hardly has time to get laid anymore."
"I'll tell the captain about the weather forecast. It might make us late in Japan."
"Captain'll love that."
"Won't we all?"
"Hey, if it screws up our alongside time, maybe I can..."
"You and me both, buddy."
The first officer grinned. Both men were single.
"Beautiful, isn't it?"
Frome asked. He leaned down, staring at the metallic mass through the Lexan sheeting. The manipulator arm had detached the plutonium from the spindle and moved it for a visual inspection that wasn't really necessary, but the plutonium had to be moved for the next part of the finishing process anyway, and Frome wanted to see the thing close up. He shined a small, powerful flashlight on the metal, but then switched it off. The reflection of the overhead lights was enough.
"It really is amazing," Gon said.
What they looked at might easily have been a piece of blown glass, so smooth it appeared. In fact, it was far smoother than that. The uniformity of the outside surface was so exact that the greatest distorting effect came from gravity. Whatever imperfections there might have been were far too small to see with the naked eye, and were definitely below the design tolerances Frome had established when he'd worked on the hydro codes on the mini-computer. The outside of the folded cylinder was perfect, reflecting light like some sort of eccentric lens. As the arm rotated it around the long axis, the placement and size of the reflected ceiling lights did not move or waver. Even the German found that remarkable.
"I would never have believed we could do so well," Gon said.
Frome nodded.
"Such things were not possible until quite recently. The air-bearing lathe technology is hardly 15 years old, and the laser control systems are newer still. The main commercial application is still for ultra-fine instruments like astronomical telescopes, very high-quality lenses, special centrifuge parts."
The German stood.
"Now, we must also polish the inside surfaces, those we cannot visually inspect. Why do the outside first? This way we can be sure that the machine is performing properly. The laser will control the inside. We know now, you see, that it is giving us good data."
That explanation wasn't really true, but Frome didn't want to give the real one. He truly thought this beautiful. The young Arab might not understand.
Das ist die schwarze Kunst.
It actually was rather Faustian, Frome thought, wasn't it?
How very strange, Gon thought, that something so wonderfully shaped could... Things continue to go well.
Indeed, Frome replied. He gestured to the interior of the enclosure. When run properly, the lathe trimmed off something almost like metallic thread, but thinner, visibly mainly because of its reflectivity.
a singularly valuable thread. It was collected for remelting and possible future use.
A good stopping place, Fromm said, turning away.
I agree.
They'd been at it for 14 hours. Gone dismissed the men. He and Fromm walked out too, leaving the room to the custody of the two security guards. The guards were not highly educated men. Selected from the commander's personal retinue of followers, each was the veteran of many years of combat operations. Perversely, their fighting had been more against fellow Arabs than their putative Zionist enemies. There was a plethora of terrorist groups, and since each drew its support from the Palestinian community, there was competition for the limited pool of followers. Competition among men with guns not infrequently led to confrontation and death. In the case of the guards, it also proved their loyalty. Each of the men on duty was an expert shot, about good enough to be on a par with the new American addition to the organization, the infidel Russell. One of the guards, Ahmed, lit up a cigarette and leaned against the wall. He faced yet another boring night. Walking guard on the outside or patrolling the block on which Kati slept at least gave them a variety of things to observe. One might imagine that there was an Israeli agent behind every parked car or behind every window, and such thoughts kept one awake and alert. Not here. Here they guarded machines that sat dumbly still. For diversion, and also in keeping with their duties, the guards kept an eye on the machinists, following them around the room, to and from their eating and sleeping spaces, and even on some of their less complicated jobs. Though not well educated, Ahmed was a bright man, quick to learn, and he fancied that he could have done any of these machinist jobs, given a few months to learn the trade properly. He was very good with weapons, able to diagnose a problem or fix an improper sight as quickly and well as a master gunsmith. As he walked around, he listened to the drone of the blowers for the various air systems, and on each circuit he looked at the instrument panels that reported their status. The panels also monitored the backup generators, making sure each night that there was sufficient fuel in the tanks.
They are awfully worried about this schedule, aren't they? Ahmed mused.
He continued his walk around, hoping the indicator light would blink off. He and his companion stopped to look at the same metallic bar that had so interested Fromm and Ghosn.
What do you suppose that is?
Something wondrous, Ahmed said. Certainly they are keeping it as secret as they can.
I think it's part of an atomic bomb.
Ahmed turned.
Why do you say that? One of the machinists said it could be nothing else.
Wouldn't that be something to give to our Israeli friends?
After all the Arabs who've died in the last few years, the Israelis, the Americans, all the rest. Yes, it would be a fine gift.
They continued their walk past the idle machines.
I wonder what the rush is.
Whatever it is, they want it finished on time.
Ahmed paused again, looking at the plethora of metal and plastic parts on the assembly table.
An atomic bomb?
He asked himself. But some of these things looked like soda straws, long, thin ones, wrapped in tight bundles and twisted slightly.
Soda straws? In an atomic bomb?
That was not possible. An atomic bomb had to be...
What?
He admitted to himself that he had no idea at all. Well, he was able to read the Quran and the newspapers and weapons manuals. It wasn't his fault he hadn't had the chance to have proper schooling like Ghosn, whom he liked in a distant and slightly jealous way. Such a fine thing, an education. If only his own father had been something more than a displaced peasant, a shop owner, perhaps, someone able to save a little money. On his next circuit, he saw the paint can. That's what it looked like. The metal shavings from the lathe were collected from the Freon sump. Ahmed had seen the process often enough. The scrap, it looked mainly like very fine metallic thread, was collected mechanically and loaded into the container, which did look very much like a paint can, using a window and thick rubber gloves.
The can was then placed into a double-door chamber and removed, taken to the next room, and opened in another similar chamber and put into one of those odd crucibles.
"I'm going outside for a piss," his companion said.
"Enjoy the fresh air," Ahmed observed. Ahmed slung his weapon and watched his friend go out the double doors. He'd take a stroll soon himself, when it was time to check the perimeter security. He was the senior man, and was responsible for the outside guards, in addition to the security of the shop itself. It was worth it just to get out of the controlled environment of the machine shop. This was no way for a man to live, Ahmed thought, stuck inside a sealed enclosure like a space station or submarine. He craved an education, but not to be an office worker, sitting down all the time and staring at papers. No, to be an engineer, the sort who built roads and bridges, that was an ambition he might once have held. Perhaps his son would be one, if he ever had the chance to marry and have a son. Something to dream for. His dreams were more limited now. For this to end, to be able to set his gun down, to have a real life, that was his primary dream. But the Zionists had to die first. Ahmed stood alone in the room, bored to death. At least the outside guards could look at the stars. Something to do. Something to do. The paint can sat there, inside the enclosure. It appeared to be ready for the transfer. He'd watched the machinists do it often enough. What the hell? Ahmed removed the can from the airlock and walked it into the furnace room. They put it inside the electric furnace, and it was simple enough. And he was glad to be able to do something different, maybe something helpful to whatever project this was. The can was light, might have held only air for all he could tell. Was it empty? The top was held on with clamps, and no, he decided. He'd just do what the machinists did. Ahmed walked to the furnace, opened the door, checked to see that the power was off. This thing got hot, he knew. It melted metal. Next, he put on the thick rubber gloves they used, and, forgetting to switch on the argon flooding system, loosened the clamps on the can. He rotated the can backwards so that he could see what it looked like. He saw. As he removed the top, the oxygen-laden air entered the can and attacked the plutonium filaments, some of which reacted at once, essentially exploding in his face. There was a flash, as though from a rifle primer. Just a tiny puff of heat and light, certainly nothing to endanger a man, he knew at once. Not even any smoke that he noticed immediately, though he did sneeze once. Despite that, Ahmed was seized with terror. He'd done something he ought not to have done. What would the commander think of him? What might the commander do to him? He listened to the air conditioning system and thought he saw a puff of thin smoke rising into the exhaust vent. That was good. The electric dust collector plates would take care of that. All he had to do... Yes. He resealed the can and carried it back into the machine shop. His fellow guard hadn't returned yet. Good. Ahmed slid the can back where it had been and made sure that things looked as they had looked a few minutes earlier. He lit another cigarette to relax himself, vexed with himself that he was as yet unable to quit the habit. It was starting to impede his running. Ahmed didn't know that he was already a corpse whose death had not yet been registered, and that his cigarette might as easily have been the breath of life itself.
"I can do it," Clark announced, striding through the door like John Wayne into the Alamo. "Tell me about it," Jack said, waving to a chair. "I just got back from Dulles, talked to a few people. The JAL-747 set up for transpac flights are arranged very conveniently for us. The upstairs lounge is set up with beds, like an old Pullman car. It helps us. The room is very lively acoustically, and that makes for easy pickup." He laid out a diagram. "There's a table here and here. We use 2 wireless bugs and 4 broadcast channels."
"Explain," Jack said.
"The wireless bugs are omnidirectional.
Okay, they transmit to the SHF transmitter, and that one gets it out of the airplane.
Why four channels?
The big problem is canceling out the airplane noise, the engine whine, the air, all that stuff. Two channels are interior sound. The other two are for background noise only. We use that to cancel out the crap. We have people down in S&T who have been working on that for quite a while. You use the recorded background noise to establish what the interference is, then just change its phase to cancel it out. Pretty simple stuff if you have the right computer backup equipment. We do. Okay? The transmitter goes in a bottle. We aim it out a window. Easy to do. I checked. Now, we will need a chase plane.
Like what?
With the right equipment, a business jet like a Gulfstream. Better yet, an EC-135. I'd recommend more than one. Have them form up and break off.
How far away?
As long as it's line of sight. Up to 30 miles, and doesn't have to be the same altitude. Not like we have to fly formation on the guy.
How hard to build it?
Simple. The hardest part is the battery, and that'll fit in a liquor bottle, like I said. We'll make it a brand that you usually find in a duty-free store. I have a guy checking that. One with a ceramic bottle instead of a glass one. Like an expensive bottle of Chivas, maybe. The Japanese like their scotch.
Detection? Ryan asked. Clark grinned like a teenager who just snookered a teacher.
We build the system exclusively from Japanese components, and we place a receiver tuned to the right freaks in the aircraft. He'll be traveling with the usual mob of newsies. I'll set a receiver in the waste bin of one of the downstairs heads. If the op gets burned, they'll think it was one of their own. It'll even look like a journalist did it.
Ryan nodded. Nice touch, John.
I thought you'd like that. When the bird lands, we have a guy recover the bottle. We'll fix it. I mean, we'll see to it that you can't get the cork out. Super glue, maybe.
Getting aboard in Mexico City?
I have Ding looking at that. Time you got a taste for planning operations, and this is the soft side. My Spanish is good enough to fool a Mexican national.
Back to the bugging equipment. We won't be reading this in real time?
No way.
Clark shook his head.
What'll come across will be garbled, but we'll use high-speed tape machines to record. Then we can wash it through the pewters downstairs to get clean copy. It's an additional operational safeguard. The guys in the chase birds won't know what they're listening to, and only the drivers need to know who they're shadowing. Maybe not even that, as a matter of fact. I have to check on that.
How long to produce clean copy?
Have to do it at this end, say a couple of hours. That's what the S&T guys say, anyway. You know the real beauty of this?
Tell me.
Airplanes are about the last place you can't bug. Our S&T guys have been playing with it for a long time. What made the breakthrough came from the Navy. Very black project. Nobody knows we can do this. The computer codes are very complex. Lots of people are playing with it, but the actual breakthrough was on the theoretical side of the math. Came from a guy at NSA. I repeat, Sir John, nobody knows this is possible. Their security guys will be asleep. If they find the bug, they'll think it's an amateur attempt to do something. The receiver I put aboard won't actually recover anything usable to anyone but us.
And we'll have a guy recover that also, to back up the aerial transmissions.
That's right. So we have double redundancy. Or triple. I never have figured what the right terminology is. Three separate channels for the information, one in the plane and two being beamed out from it.
Ryan raised his coffee mug in salute.
Okay. Now that the technical side looks possible, I want an operational feasibility evaluation. You got it, Jack. God damn. It's good to be a real spy again. With all due respect, watching out for your ass does not test my abilities all that much.
I love you too, John. Ryan laughed. It was his first in too long a time. If they could pull this one off, maybe that Elliot bitch would get off his back for once. Maybe the president would understand that field operations with real live field officers were still useful. It would be a small victory.
Chapter 25. Resolution.
So what's the story on the things? The second officer asked, looking down at the cargo deck.
Supposed to be the roof beams for a temple. Small one, I guess, the first officer noted. How much more will these seas build?
I wish we could slow down, Pete.
I've talked to him twice about it. Captain says he has a schedule to meet.
Tell that to the fucking ocean.
Haven't tried that. Who do you call?
The second officer, who had the watch, snorted. The first officer, the ship's second in command, was on the bridge to keep an eye on things. That was actually the captain's job, but the ship's master was asleep in his bed. MVV George MacReady was pounding through 30-foot waves, trying to maintain 20 knots, but failing despite full cruising power on her engines. The sky was overcast, with occasional breaks in the clouds for the full moon to peek through. The storm was actually breaking up, but the wind was holding steady at 60 knots, and the seas were still increasing somewhat. It was a typical North Pacific storm, both officers had already decided. Nothing about it made any sense. The air temperature was a balmy 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and the flying spray was freezing to ice that impacted the bridge windows like birdshot in duck season. The only good news was that the seas were right on the bow. George M. was a freighter, not a cruise liner, and lacked anti-roll stabilizers. In fact, the ride wasn't bad at all. The superstructure was set on the after portion of the ship, and that damped out most of the pitching motion associated with heavy seas. It also had the effect of reducing the officer's awareness of events at the forward end of the ship, a fact further accentuated by the reduced visibility from flying spray. The ride also had a few interesting characteristics. When the bow plowed into an especially high wave, the ship slowed down. But the size of the ship meant that the bow slowed quicker than the stern, and as the deceleration forces fought to reduce ship's speed, the hull rebelled by shuddering. In fact, the hull actually bent a few inches, something difficult to believe until it was seen.
I served on a carrier once. They flex more than a foot in the middle. Once we were...
Look dead ahead, sir, the helmsman called.
Oh, shit, the second officer shouted. Rogue wave!
Suddenly, there it was, a 50-footer just 100 yards from the George M.'s blunt bow. The event was not unexpected. Two waves would meet and add their heights for a few moments, then diverge. The bow rose on one medium-sized crest, then dropped before the onrushing green wall.
Here we go!
There wasn't time for the bow to climb over this one. The Greenwater simply stepped over the bow as though it had never been there and kept rolling aft the 500 feet to the superstructure. Both officers watched in detached fascination. There was no real danger to the ship. At least, they both told themselves no immediate danger. The solid green mass came past the heavy cargo handling masts and equipment, advancing at a speed of 30 miles per hour. The ship was already shuddering again, the bow having hit the lower portion of the wave, slowing the ship. In fact, the bow was still underwater, since this wave was far broader than it was high, but the top portion was about to hit a white-painted steel cliff that was perpendicular to its axis of advance.
Brace! The second officer told the helmsman.
The crest of the wave didn't quite make the level of the bridge, but it did hit the windows for the senior officers' cabins. Instantly, there was a white vertical curtain of spray that blotted out the entire world. The single second it lasted seemed to stretch into a minute. Then it cleared, and the ship's deck was exactly where it was supposed to be, though covered with seawater that was struggling to drain out the scuppers. George M. took a 15-degree roll, then settled back down.
Drop speed to 16 knots, my authority, the first officer said.
Aye, the helmsman acknowledged.
We're not going to break this ship while I'm on the bridge, the senior officer announced.
Makes sense to me, Pete. The second officer was on his way to the trouble board, looking for an indicator light for flooding or other problems. The board was clear. The ship was designed to handle seas far worse than this, but safety at sea demanded vigilance.
Okay here, Pete.
The growler phone rang.
Bridge, first officer here.
What the hell was that? The chief engineer demanded.
Well, it was sorta a big wave, Cheng, Pete answered laconically. Any problems?
No kidding.